Welcome again to The End of Religion, a podcast exploring the subversive spirituality of Jesus. I'm Bruxy Cavey, the author of a book called The End of Religion, and I'm not alone.
And I'm Tim Day, senior pastor of the Meeting House, partner in crime with Brux.
We're going to take a look today at, we're working our way through the book, The End of Religion, as just a base for our discussions, although we're using it as a launching pad to head off in different directions of exploration. Today we're at chapter one, Water, Wine, and Scandal. I wrote this chapter just as a foretaste for some of the historical Jesus discussion that we would get into in part two of the book. Part two really walks through episodes in the life of Christ as recorded in the biblical Gospels. But we want to at least give people a taste of that early on in the book. And that's what this chapter is designed to do, to raise questions. So if you're walking through this in a discussion group or just on your own, it doesn't answer a lot of questions but raises questions, that's good. That's what it's supposed to do. And you know how sometimes movies start with kind of a scene that kind of grabs your attention. It has some action, but it just it doesn't necessarily develop the plot very much. It just kind of leads you in and makes you want to try and figure out what's going on. Hopefully that's what this is doing for some of us as we discuss things today. Tim, okay, what are some of the things that come to mind? The chapter talks about the first miracle of Jesus turning water into wine. And as he does that, he actually uses religious icons, the jars that hold the holy water, mm-hmm. and has them serve the wine out of that. Reading through the chapter, what are some things that come to mind to you?
It's one of those visual pictures. It's one of those images that, again, Jesus was so good at taking situations and transforming them into learning experiences. Mm. And he would, you know, I think he was a master at that sort of old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words. Mm. And so when he acts, he never is unintentional, just allowing happenstance. He's always very well thought through. And so the notion of him looking around to pick those holy water jugs, as you point out, you know, there's lots of jugs he could have used. Yeah. He bypassed the obvious to select specifically jugs that were meant to be treated with a certain amount of reverence and of religious function.
Right.
And so we realize that this is something very intentional. The thing that strikes me out of this, and it's a phrase that you use in the book, he said about replacing holy water with wedding wine. Mm. And one of the things that really jumps out at me in this opening scene, the sort of seed that he plants, that as you get further into his ministry, you look back on and realize, wow, this was pregnant with meaning.
Yeah.
Is that this image of him replacing the holy water in their experience, that sort of reminder of religion, that get yourself cleaned up before you do anything else. Mm-hmm. You have to wash, and not just wash once, wash many times, because the reality is you're just sinning over and over again. Mm. He's replacing this religious, ritualistic emblem in their midst.
So the water, in a sense, is not just a symbol of cleansing, it's a symbol of your need for cleansing. It's
ongoing
need
for
cleansing.
So it's
also a symbol of your dirtiness.
Yeah, your dirtiness. It's a reminder of how dirty you are.
Yeah.
And yet it offers the hope that if you keep washing, you know, for the next few minutes, you're okay.
Right.
Until you have
right.
to wash again. And he replaces all of that. He sort of blows it all away, and he desecrates the item. And he says, let's jump right into partying.
Hmm.
We're going to jump right into this wedding wine, this image. And in Israel, the wine was the image of celebration, of blessing, of God's sort of rich outpouring of lavish grace and favor on them based on their covenant relationship. When they experienced wine in community, as a lot of times people do today,
right?
When you crack open a bottle of wine, it's a symbol of celebrating relationship, celebrating life.
Right.
And he says, let's jump over. And so what I think is a wonderful picture for us is here's Jesus coming and saying, not only am I going to replace religion, but we're going to jump over everything religion tells you you need to do.
Hmm.
We're going to jump right to the party at the end.
Hmm.
Religion comes to you and says, look, you've got to get yourself cleaned up. You have to learn these new secret truths, or you have to get your behavior in line. And when you finally climb the staircase, so you work your way up this pyramid of religion, and you reach the top, then you'll be able to celebrate. Jesus says, forget it all. We're kicking off this whole new way of looking at life, this whole new approach to God with the party. Day one, we're starting with the wine.
Often people misunderstand that the message of grace then is that grace is some It is some holy word that refers to how bad you are and therefore how much God has to put up with you.
Yes.
But regardless, I think we are actually kind of screwed up. We shouldn't have to be so insecure that we're always trying to tell ourselves, I'm not so bad. Well, you are. You're a dirty, rotten sinner, and so am I. But at the same time, God created us. He called us into this world. He loves us. We exist because he said, I want to have a world with one of you in it.
Yes.
You know, whatever your name is, to say, I wanted a world with a Tim. I wanted a world with a Bruxy. And so, yes, we mess up, but God loves us. And so grace then is that opportunity for us to realize that God is going to, he's got the rescue plan. He's got it all set on how he's going to get us back to where we need to be. And with that, our kind of faith, our trust in that, we can actually just allow God to save us, God to do that, and we can celebrate with him. We don't have to do any more rituals to get there. He gets us there and then says, now just come and celebrate. It's already done.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, he punched out of the middle that section that we think we have to go through intuitively to get right with God. And Jesus, what we find in the unfolding story is he is over and over again replacing everything that the Jews, his own people, thought was needed to get right with God. He's replacing it with himself. And essentially saying, look at the story of the Old Testament is, you know, you're never going to get there. You're never going to get up the ladder. You're never going to get changed enough. You're never going to get it all sorted out enough. So let's change our whole approach. I'm going to do it for you once and for all so that all of you, instead of starting at the bottom of the ladder and then working your whole life to get somewhere, can actually stop right at the top, start completely restored in relationship with each other, restored in relationship with God, and knowing that even in your mistakes now, they're set in a whole new context. They're set in a context of God's grace that is bigger and more powerful and is able to essentially unleash us into a life where we can truly start to become other-centered. You see, as long as we're obsessing about our own failures, as long as we're obsessing about our own issues,
and our own need for salvation, if I'm busy trying to get myself to heaven,
yes,
I haven't got time really
to
worry about you. Or if I do worry about you, it's still only just an expression of my continued spiritual narcissism. I'm only worrying about you because worrying about you is just one more step in me getting to heaven.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, in my own experience, in those seasons of my life where I'm worried about my own sort of achieving some sort of status or getting command of some area of my life, it's very easy for me to obsess. I'm thinking about it all the time. Somebody can be in desperate need right beside me, and I'm actually more worried about me than them. And I think, wow, just let's all pause and take a look at the history of religion and maybe even the context of religion today. How many people are obsessed with the religious process of trying to get right and get their life in order, and yet have very little time to turn and look at truly the tragic situations around the world where people need help. And I think from a divine parent's point of view, God looking down and saying, look, can't I just give you, you know, freedom from all that so you can start loving people the way I want you to love? Like the issue of the prodigal son in a previous podcast, we talked about, you know, the prodigal son came home to get, not to go through a new get your life together process, 12 steps of getting the, you know, all the junk out of his life. The father ushered him right into the party.
But he thought he was going home to kind of work his way slowly into the father's favor again. I'll start out as a slave. Maybe I'll never get past being a servant, but I'll at least work there, and I'll live a life of repentance. Then maybe one day he'll smile in my general direction because I'm serving him so faithfully. And straight into the party.
And the great thing was the older brother who just had a terrible attitude, real grumpy about the whole thing, not getting the father's gift. What's the father pleading for him to do?
Come in to the party.
Straight into the party. The wedding wine.
Yes.
Right? There's again, Jesus is like, skip the holy water process. It's done. It's not needed anymore. This is a community that begins with celebration. This is a community that begins with true relationship where people are free. And I love the image of the wine because it is sort of a social lubricant. It is a place where we let down.
Right.
We relax.
Yeah.
We, you know, people, I'm not advocating here for drunkenness, so just be clear.
Yeah.
And no need for cards or letters. not saying that. But there is something in the nature of having a glass of wine with friends. It just relaxes people, allows people, I think it's a symbol of being yourself, being authentic.
And certainly within that culture, and that's how we need to understand Jesus, that's exactly how it was functioning. as that symbol of delight, of,
yes,
of sociality. Is that a word? I don't know, but it works. Of really engaging with extended family and friends, and with a rallying point. It's a wedding, so you have celebrating love. You're celebrating kind of the pinnacle of human expression of love. And what a fitting place then for Jesus to say, aha, this is just the perfect place to make my big debut.
The other parallel that I see with a previous story we talked about in the story of the two sons is the magnitude of this miracle. He didn't just make a little bit of wine.
Mm.
Like, it's one of those pictures where he made an insane amount of wine.
Yeah.
And again, it's sort of blowing us out of the water in terms of the proportion of his grace. That it is not something small. It's not even just there to meet a need. It goes so far beyond, it's beyond anything we could ever imagine. And same with the prodigal son. When he came home, that son that had failed, that story is told with incredible precision by Jesus to, in the early first century context, to blow them out of the water in terms of how almost foolish, insane, lavish, unbelievable was the grace of the Father.
Hmm.
And I love that this first miracle that he does has that embedded right at the core. This, the DNA of this seed is rich with that sense of God's grace.
That's awesome. This is the stuff that gets us, you know, cranked up. let me just segue into something that is less exciting, but maybe just should be talked about for a few moments. And that is letting people know that behind the scenes, Christians often debate on whether the wine that was made there was alcoholic or not. And it's fascinating because for many Christians, that becomes the obsession of this whole story. All of the amazing stuff that we're talking about gets kind of lost in the shuffle. It's amazing to me, Tim, how often I hear feedback from Christians who have read this who say, I've read the story so many times and I never noticed what was right in front of me. But I don't think that's because all Christians are particularly dull, but where our minds are filled with other things, like religious squabbles over whether or not oinos, which is the Greek word for wine, whether or not oinos is actually alcoholic or not. And so you have groups of Christians who will say, no, it couldn't be, because wine is by definition something that is decaying, and Jesus would never make something that is decaying.
Right.
And others who would say, no, wine is better than grape juice no matter how you slice it, and Jesus made the best. And in fact, within the texts, they seem to be quite surprised that he saved the best for last.
Yes.
And going back to just grape juice might not have been the best. Now, my understanding is that wine back then would have been less alcoholic than it is today. It wouldn't have been as potent as ours. But that, I think, again, loses the point and tries to find excuses for the fact that really this is about celebration.
Yes.
And we ought not turn it then into a religious argument one way or the other. We don't want to necessarily support drinking per se, but we also don't want to allow a social taboo to prevent us from seeing the absolute emphasis on celebration that this brings.
I think that's a great point. It is. It's a great example in our own recent church history, where oftentimes our own concern around sort of a codification of what is morally righteous, of what is sort of ethically acceptable, and then sort of transposing that, forcing that back on the text, ends up leaving us in a position where, if we're real honest with ourselves, we're probably saying, in this whole dialogue, we have probably become religious.
Yeah.
We have been obsessed about some sort of moral code issue, the tradition of the elders that often Jesus had to confront. And as a result, we've missed the obvious point of what Jesus was trying to say.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's also, there's something beautiful in the text and the modesty with how the story comes about, that Jesus actually is at first resistant, you know, at least apparently so, and that it's his mom who encourages him to actually step up to the plate. You know, now's your time. And it's almost as though Jesus needs her to really embrace this, because let's face it, from this moment on, his relationship with his mom is never going to be the same again. He's had now 30 years. He has grown up in the home. This has been a tender and wonderful relationship, but he is not here just to be a blessing to his mom as she grows older. He's here to offer his life for the world. And so this is that transitional moment in the text where she comes to him and he says, you know, my time's not really here. She says, oh, yes, it is. Do what he says. And He addresses her as woman, which is not as rude as it would sound in our culture. It's more acceptable back then. But it still isn't mom. It's still as though, now this is the moment you have to get ready for, mom. If you are pushing me to do this, this is the moment everything changes between us and between, you know, for everyone.
Clearly throughout the text, as it follows, Jesus was clearly aware of timing issues, of seasons. And I think you're exactly right that it is sort of artistfully told that Jesus was conscious that this is starting a sequence of events that was now going to change everything.
Yeah, no turning back. And so I do think that it's beautiful it's told that way, because it is not kind of Jesus rolling up his sleeves and pushing everyone aside and saying, stand back, I'm the Messiah, look what I can do. But even as he begins this incredible, miraculous career as Messiah, he does so in partnership, in submission, working together with those around him, and concerned for what they're going to think and feel, those closest to him. It's beautiful. Even he doesn't grandstand, you know. He's not lowered down on a, I don't know, a hoist, you know, with the fireworks and everything. Yes. It's so modest from the beginning.
Again, we see it, as you said, it's, you know, you wanted to pull a highlight out of the beginning of Jesus' ministry to sort of whet people's appetites. Mm-hmm. And the story, I think, is such a great example of again, so many layers to meaning. And it's such a, it's a story that is so pregnant with meaning, so rich. And as vindicated, this is what is played out chapter after chapter, story after story of Jesus' ministry.
The there's been occasion I've had people, well, it's been rare, but it's happened, that some Christian will say, this can't be. Bruxy, you're making this up. Those jars weren't actually used for the religious ceremonies. No, I'm sure there were no other ones there, and those were the normal wedding, those were
wine
wine jars that the text just describes, kind of, you know, they're also sacred because, and they're trying to make stuff up, which is fascinating. The conservative Christian in that discussion is having to depart from the biblical text to try and come up with a theory on why Jesus is not as scandalous and irreligious as he's appearing to be. And I, who they probably paint me as a liberal, even though I wouldn't paint myself one as such, I'm the one sticking to the text, saying it's actually the Jesus of the text here who is incredibly offensive to religious conservatives.
Yeah, and that I think is, you know, in terms of the dialogue moving forward, that's the common ground we can have for anybody who is really serious about historical biblical studies. Mm-hmm. Same with people on the other side who are saying, well, we think this, we mentioned this in a previous podcast, you know, this isn't actually rooted in history. No, actually, yeah, everybody do your homework. Just come at it from a level playing field.
Yeah.
All we're really talking about is the earliest historical record of what Jesus actually taught and did.
Yeah.
We don't have to create any scandal. Just look at it for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has to come to terms with, I think, you know, is a radical message that has been either not understood, not clearly defined, maybe. And we don't have to make anything up.
Yeah. We don't have to sensationalize it. It's pretty much
it's right there.
The funny thing is those of us who've been raised often within a Christian religious context have the hardest time seeing it. But, you know, we can read over these texts again and again and just not notice it.
We find ourselves caught as a weird parallel to the early religious leaders of Jesus' day.
Right?
Where there's maybe some people listening to this podcast who say, I haven't grown up in the church. Yeah. And I read it. And it makes sense to me. I look at the text. I got a copy of it and it makes sense. There's no baggage there. And in Jesus' day, that was exactly the experience. It was the people who were most actually obsessed with the text, right?
Right.
That were always wrestling with him in debate.
They missed the forest for the trees.
That's right.
Jesus is establishing a new covenant. We mentioned in the chapter that there was a promise in the Old Testament that a prophet like Moses would come. That's huge. That's pregnant with meaning, a prophet like Moses, because Moses was the Old Testament prophet who established the Old Covenant, that a covenant being a contract or a sacred arrangement or a sacred agreement between people, like a marriage covenant. that God is saying to Israel in the Old Covenant, I'm going to work with you. I want to partner with you in order to bring blessing to the whole world. He never had his eyes off the whole world. That's clear from God's original promises to Abraham, but that he's going to work with Israel to bring that blessing to the world. So you have the Old Covenant through Moses.
Yes.
For Jesus then to have imagery that plays off of that, turning water into wine instead of water into blood, to become yes. that new Moses
yes.
is really saying that, I mean, he's from the beginning just dropping the clues that it's time for the new covenant.
That's right.
That we're entering the new era, a new arrangement, a new agreement.
And as you just mentioned there, to unpack that concept of covenant, because I'm not sure that's well understood today. Mm. I'm not sure that we use those terms. We tend to use the word contract. I think we tend to use that a little bit more commonly when we talk about agreements.
Yeah.
And with those are embedded sort of a legal sense of responsibilities, mm-hmm. and often is not viewed relationally.
Right.
It is viewed more as a business arrangement where actually we can be quite strangers. As long as I do my part and you do your part, that's
right.
fine. Covenant has much more closer to a healthy marriage
yeah.
Vision of partnership, relationship.
So it has the sense of a clear arrangement and a clear commitment, like a business contract,
yes.
but it goes way beyond that to make it a relational, intimate version of a contract.
Right. It's a coming together of two for a common purpose that is rooted in that sense of being yoked together, of being true partners, of a greater sense of, I think, of intimacy and of union, which a lot of times the contract notion today is really just get the task done, then we're done. Where God always envisioned a greater sense of shared identity, even again using the marriage covenant. You'll be my people and I will be your God.
Yeah.
There's that sense of, no, we're really in it together. We're becoming one at the core.
Yeah.
So here when Jesus comes and says, we're going to begin a new covenant, transported forward for many of the people of this day was this immediate, wow, everything is being changed. Everything's being redefined. This isn't just about one task being completed. Now we have a new task. This is a new relational, it's a new relational commitment, experience at the very core. And it's going to transcend everything, top to bottom.
Yeah.
To have a new covenant with God was to define all the terms over again and
yeah.
start over. And
yeah.
the amazing thing, again, coming back with that kickoff picture, of changing holy water into celebration wine, again, would have, I think, as the dominoes begin to fall with his followers,
yeah.
would have been rich with meaning. Say, yeah, the Old Testament covenant, that old arrangement was very much get yourself cleaned up, get these behaviors, go through these rituals, go through these routines, these offerings, very ritualistic and yet, when Jesus comes, says we're sort of jettisoning all of this and starting with a completely new footing,
yeah.
a new foundation,
yeah.
and it's starting with celebration wine. It's starting with a huge party
right.
where everybody's welcomed into community. That would have signaled to them, "Wow, this is all changing."
Yes, it now is the era of that new covenant. It was promised in the Old Testament. By the way, testament and covenant can be used interchangeably. If you're new to the Bible, it's divided into Old Testament and New Testament. They can also think of that as Old Covenant. It's the Old Covenant story, the pre-Jesus, and the New Testament is the New Covenant era.
The old way and the new way.
The old way and the new way, you could say, yeah. And so Jesus, he doesn't use the word New Covenant in this story. He will later. By the end of his life, he will say at the Last Supper, he will talk about the New Covenant that he's giving people. But here he says it through his actions.
Yes.
The beautiful thing about Jesus is that he's God's show and tell, right? He doesn't just teach stuff. He'll show you. Sometimes he teaches it, then later you see it. Like when he talks about loving your enemy, he'll teach that with words. But then you see him actually live it out. You see what it looks like in his life. So he's a wonderful mentor in that way because if he speaks and then he shows you. In this case, he's showing first. He's dropping hints. And then later he will explain it. And so if you look at references and passages in the Gospels to the Last Supper, you'll see him talk about it being a new covenant. Paul also quotes Jesus that way in 1 Corinthians 11. Hey, a couple other things before we wrap up, Tim. If Jesus were coming today, because you've drawn some parallels between religion today and religion then, and
yes.
how Jesus kind of has to... It's like he has to give them shock treatment, right? to get them out of their religious slumber.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think that's often the case. The more religious someone is, the more I think we just start to feel safe and secure from all alarm within my worldview, the way I've always done things. And so it's easy to just kind of lose sight of the areas that you need to change.
Yes.
Because you're always pointing out how the sinners need to change much more than you. So in first century Israel, that was certainly the case. It's the case today, too. If Jesus needed to give us some shock treatment today, I'm just thinking kind of wildly. What do you think he would do? What would he have to come and do among us as, say, conservative, Bible-loving Christians to kind of shock us out of just our religious traditionalism? You know, what would be the modern-day equivalent of serving wine out of the holy water jars?
Oh, you're going to get me in trouble here. So, okay, here's an image.
It's just brainstorm.
It just popped in my head.
Yeah.
Imagine this, though. Let's say, you know, there's a conservative church in a downtown area busy, and they invite Jesus today to come and do the Sunday night message.
Okay.
So in behind him is a big baptismal tank. It's a it's a church that baptizes that way.
Yeah.
So before he gets up, he goes in the back, takes a look. Hey, there's some water in there.
Yeah.
Does a miracle, turns it into wine.
Turns to wine.
Pulls out the cups. And says, I want to kick open the doors tonight. We're going to have a party. I want you to invite everybody in the street.
Yeah.
We've got the best aged wine ever.
Yes.
We're going to just
serving it out of the baptismal tank in the communion cups.
In the communion cups.
Well, they're shot glasses. We're doing Jello shots. Maybe he'd thicken it up a bit. And I don't know.
There'd be something along that line that for the church I grew up in, if that happened, I don't know what people would do. They'd be just...
They'd say, this can't be.
This can't be.
The real Jesus.
Right.
Right? We would, we might not actually do it, but we would say, we'd mutter under our breath, crucify him. Yeah. Right? This guy's got to go.
Oh, yeah. If they weren't sure of his identity, they would probably think he's a sorcerer.
Yes,
or something
terrible,
or that he snuck in and did something. He's making a mockery.
Right. Even if this is a miracle, you can't argue against the miraculous nature of this event, then you'd start to theorize where he gets his power from, and it's not God.
Yeah, it must be demonic.
Yeah, which is what they later accused Jesus of.
Accused him of. So that sort of crazy imagery comes to mind. I think probably for a lot of us, it is actually in a lot of the same ways that he shocked the people of his day, which was the quality of his parties the sort of makeup of his company in terms of he was incredible and inviting people into a celebration of life. And he did it with everybody, you know, and you can't even say that he never reached out to any religious people. It was really he included everybody. Like you look at even the list that would become his disciples, he was intentional bringing together people of warring factions like a zealot who is politically motivated to get the Romans out with a tax collector who is sort of hated for being in the pocket of the Romans.
Right. One of his disciples being called Simon the Zealot and the other being Matthew as a tax collector.
Yes.
Yes. And he pulls them both together and says, let's learn to be family.
Let's learn how to be family. Again, at times welcoming a Pharisee and wanting to relate.
Yeah.
And yet at another time, defending a woman caught in adultery.
Right.
There's a sense of his inclusiveness in community.
Mm-hmm.
And then this regular reputation of him being a drunkard, of being a partier.
Yes. That was the reputation.
That was his reputation.
Wasn't true.
A friend of... It wasn't true. He wasn't a drunkard.
It seems as though he would have drank. He drank and allowed others to drink, and he created wine.
He created wine,
and of course, the religious people immediately go to.
You're a drunkard.
You're a drunkard. You're encouraging drunkenness.
That's right.
And they obsess about that, which is exactly again what happened within the first century.
So I would think today, probably in many religious circles, just the nature of somebody who would be that inclusive, that. Placing that high a priority on celebrating life and prioritizing that type of, just everybody having a great time together.
Mm.
Just even that, I think, would shock.
Yeah, I think you
would
right.
shock us and wake us up.
I think you're right. For our last, you guys can brainstorm more if you're working this through. That's in the Q&A section of the chapter of this book, and feel free to brainstorm other ways you think Jesus might have to shock us. And when I think of shocking too, it's worth saying that. we don't see Jesus trying to be offensive or shocking just for its own sake.
Yes.
This is not a call to, because there's always going to be that person who's just a little rebellious and says, well, I love this Jesus because it means I can go around and give people a finger, you know?
Yeah.
And I can. And he's not just trying to shock people for its own sake. Every bit of scandal has a deep theological punch behind
yes.
it. There's meaning, and he's shocking the religious addictions of people. He's not just saying, well, if you have a tradition, I will try and upset you. But if you are addicted to that tradition, or if you are trying to use some other system to get to God, then yes, okay, I have to shock you to get you to let go of that. But I just, every so often over the years, Tim, I have to say, I've had people come up to me and they kind of miss the point.
Yes.
They think, oh, Jesus gives me license to be rebellious and to just kind of cause problems in the church or in whatever religious community for its own sake. And they usually come up to me like they want to be my friend, and they're saying, hey, Bruxy, I really love that. And I can tell in their attitude, I just want to say, stay off my side. You know, you're not, this is not the attitude of Christ. But the purpose and the mission comes first. If shock value has to be part of that, then so be it.
I fully agree. I think there are people who are angry mm-hmm. at leadership,
yes,
angry
right.
at maybe painful things that have happened in the past. And they use this message as a license for them to sort of either passive aggressively or more aggressively
mm-hmm.
sort of act out of their anger. And I see in Jesus in his final days in Jerusalem, sort of the center of this religious battle he is waging, yeah. him weeping mm-hmm. over Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think what you see revealed there is a very humble heart, a very broken heart,
mm-hmm.
that at times, yeah, he wants to rattle their cages, but it's very thoughtful.
Yeah.
It's very focused on simply trying to give people the best chance to wake up.
Yeah.
And then immediately responding with grace and kindness to those people. And I think, again, many times people want to take this message for license
yeah.
or for a reason to be angry, and
yeah.
they miss the heart.
That's right. Jesus got angry at the same people he's also willing to cry over, you know, and really mourn over as well. And if someone's listening to this and they're only doing the anger thing, then they haven't got the heart of Christ, right? This also has to be something that's worth mourning and weeping over as well. That is the religious hypocrisy that's out there.
And I would add to that within me.
Yeah,
I think if you actually allow the message to be applied to yourself first,
mm-hmm.
if it gets to the core, you actually look out at other people with a real almost tenderness to realize, because you realize, you know, what can I do to help them?
Yeah.
Not what am I doing to judge them?
Right. Because I see them in me.
Yeah. The biggest issue in my life is what's in my own heart.
Yeah.
It's not actually what's in the church, what's in the world. Mm. And I think that's the power of the message of Jesus is not that if we all clean up the exterior world or somebody mm-hmm. can come around and kick everybody in the butt and get mm-hmm. the externals cleaned up,
yeah.
then we'll be okay. No, it's totally of the matter of the heart.
Yeah.
And let me add one more thing just as a side note. I think sometimes people use this story as a license to get drunk, that they think, oh, grace,
yeah,
Jesus
right.
is a partier.
Yeah.
I can get drunk. And it's not a big deal for me to have too many glasses of wine. I just want to say, I want to check that attitude too.
Yeah.
And that's not being religious. That's just coming back to the purpose of celebration is relationship, not self-indulgence. And it is okay to celebrate and have a great time. But the consistent teaching of Jesus, as well as through the New Testament, is that we're actually supposed to be filled up. As you look at Ephesians
5:18.
Right? You're supposed to be filled up, not on wine, not getting drunk on wine,
mm-hmm.
but be filled up with God's presence, his love sort of exploding in your heart.
Yeah.
And that giving you that joy and a celebration of life. Now that can be lived out once you have that true, I'm going to say new wine,
yeah.
that new sort of work of God in your life. You can drink, you know, a glass of wine or celebrate with friends.
Sure.
And it's all in proper perspective.
Right. But the goal of altered state of consciousness is still just self-indulgent and non-relational.
Yes.
And God's never about that.
He's not about that.
Yeah. And the only substance that should alter your state of consciousness should be the Spirit of God.
That's right.
Right? Yeah, that's good. Thanks for bringing us back to that. Let me just read something by way of closing. We talked about Jesus bringing in the new covenant, being the new Moses in a sense.
Yes.
And And by the way, when you read his Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, his Sermon on the Mount, is kind of the relational version of Moses bringing the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, off the Mount. You know, it really is, and that's just one of dozens of hints throughout the New Testament writings that Jesus is the new Moses in that sense of ushering his people into a new relationship. In the Old Testament, this was prophesied. The Old Testament is not heading in a certain direction, and then suddenly Jesus comes with a plot twist that no one could have ever anticipated. The Old Testament always gave clues and hints, and sometimes just straightforwardly promised that the Old Covenant isn't season, and it's not good enough to last, that there is a new covenant coming. And I thought we'd just look at one of those passages that kind of prepares the way for the coming of Christ with this new Mosaic imagery as the new Moses with bringing in the new covenant. In Jeremiah, one of the Old Testament prophets, Jeremiah writes this as a prophecy, as a promise of God. Jeremiah, if you want to read it for yourself, look up Jeremiah 31. And you can start with verse 27 and onward. And I'll just skip in the middle of it for the sake of time. Say around verse 31 of Jeremiah 31. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. God says himself, a new covenant is something I will make with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant, so it's different too, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day in which I took them by the hand, led them out of Egypt. You know, the covenant that they broke, even though I was a husband to them. So, you know, I tried to, it's that marriage covenant, but they kept becoming rebellious, leaving me, going away, you know, committing spiritual adultery in that sense, and looking everywhere else but God for satisfaction. He says there's going to be a new covenant. We're going to renew our vows in a sense, but actually the whole nature of the relationship is going to go through a dramatic change. It's not going to be like the old one. And part of the description of what that new covenant will be like, he says in verse 33 of Jeremiah 31, is that this new covenant that I make with them will be one in which I will put my law within them. Old covenant, Moses comes off the mountaintop with the law written in stone for people to read and try and follow. New covenant, he says, I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. And then you won't necessarily need each person to teach his brother or his sister or his neighbor to say, you need to know God, because people will know me from the inside out and I'll forgive their sin. So you won't have to say, well, look at those commands on the stone tablets. What do they mean? How do we follow them? What should we do? Well, this is what I think you have to do. But actually, it'll be written in our heart. There'll be what Jesus teaches will intuitively resonate with what the Spirit is already doing inside of us, pulling us toward him. And yes, then we will learn from one another, but we learn from one another as spiritual family. Brothers and sisters come along alongside each other, saying, what is God saying to you? And let me point out what Jesus is saying and how the two can connect together. And this is something that was promised, something that was anticipated by God's people, and when it came, was still so shocking that it was hard for many of them to see it. And I wonder if today there may be many people who are praying, Lord, we want more of you. We want to see your Spirit active in our midst, in our church, in our nation. God, blow through this country and, you know, get us back to God. There I get into my grandpa preaching voice. You know, get us back to God. And if God were to actually answer that prayer and give them more of his heart, they would be so shocked and scandalized at the form it took. They might say, no, this can't be the answer to my prayer. So it's worth, I think, all of us kind of assessing our own lives and saying, what's the preconceived notions that I bring of who Jesus should be and how God is supposed to work that might blind me from actually seeing what's actually going on in history, in the text, and maybe going on in my own heart in dialogue with God?
Yeah, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, am I more addicted to the holy water approach to life and thinking that what this nation needs is more cleansing?
Yeah, right.
And if
More rules.
Yeah,
more public displays. If we can get the Ten Commandments
back
put up
in the courtrooms
and get a parade or a nativity scene or something that will somehow make people follow Jesus.
Right. That we're bonded to all those forms of religious icons.
Yes.
And that if Jesus came, he would come and say...
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I just thought of a new one. So what if Jesus came and he kicked over the nativity scene?
You right. know? Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he said, look, it's not about this, people. It's not about this.
Oh, we're getting into dangerous ground.
No. All right. So,
but you can see where this goes. And it's a challenge to our own hearts.
You're right. Well, we do need to shut this down before we give people too many excuses to write us. But remember, we do have a feedback email. It's timday@themeetinghouse. Oh, no, sorry.
Let's correct that one. Thank you.
Right. We have a feedback.
I get enough emails.
That's true, you do. We got a feedback email address for this podcast. It's just feedback@theendofreligion.org. One word, feedback@theendofreligion.org. And we'd love to hear from you and find out what either questions, comments, concerns are. Be great to turn this monologue into a dialogue as much as we can. Well, actually, we're having a dialogue, aren't we, Tim?
Yep.
And we're enjoying our dialogue.
Definitely.
We just want to include other people in the conversation. And here we are at that awkward ending.
So, see you next time.
That was well done.
All right.
We'll go with that.